Chapter 9. Tangles. Perrin woke before first light, as usual, and as usual, Fael was already up and about. She could make a mouse seem noisy when she wanted to, and he suspected that if he woke an hour after lying down, she would still manage to be up first. The door flaps were tied back, the side panels raised a little at the bottom, and a stir of air rose through the vent hole in the peak, enough to create an illusion of coolness. Perrin actually shivered while searching for his shirt and breeches. Well, it was supposed to be winter, even if the weather did not know it. He dressed in the dark and scrubbed his teeth with salt, needing no lamps, and when he left the tent, stamping his feet into his boots, Fael had her new servants gathered around her in the deep grayness of early morning, some holding lighted lanterns. A lord's daughter needed servants. He should have arranged for it before this. There were two rivers folk in Camelin that Fael had trained herself, but with the need for secrecy, there had been no way to fetch them along. Master Gil would want to go home as soon as possible, and Lamgwyn and Brianna with him. But maybe Megden and Linny would stay. Aram straightened from where he had been sitting cross-legged beside the tent, and waited silently on Perrin. If Perrin had not stopped him, Aram would have slept across the entrance. This morning his coat was striped red and white, though the white was a trifle dingy, and even here that wolf-head pummeled sword hilt rose over his shoulder. Perrin had left his axe in the tent, and grateful to be rid of it. Talanvor still wore his sword belted over his coat, but not Master Gil or the other two. Fael must have been watching, because no sooner did Perrin come out than she gestured toward the tent, clearly issuing orders. Megden and Brianna came bustling past him and Aram with lanterns, their jaws set, smelling of determination for some reason. Neither curtsied, a pleasant surprise. Linny did, a quick bend of the knee before she darted after the other two, muttering about knowing their place. Perrin suspected Linny was one of those women who saw her place as being in charge. Come to think of it, most women did. That was the way of the world, it seemed, not just the two rivers. Talanvor and Lamgwyn followed close behind the women, and Lamgwyn was as serious about bowing as Talanvor, who was almost grim. Perrin sighed and bowed back, and they both gave a start, gaping at him. A curt shout from Linny jerked them into the tent. With only a quickly flashed smile for him, Fael strode off toward the carts, talking alternately to Basil Gill on one side of her, and Seben Balwer on the other. The men each held a lantern out to light her way. Of course, a double handful of those idiots kept pace where they could hear if she raised her voice, strutting and stroking sword hilts and staring about in the dimness as though they expected an attack or hoped for one. Perrin tugged at his short beard. She always found plenty of work to fill her hours, and nobody took it out of her hands. Nobody would dare. Not so much as the first fingers of dawn showed on the horizon yet, but the Cariennan were beginning to stir around the carts, and moving more quickly the closer Fael came. By the time she reached them, they appeared to be trotting, their lanterns bobbing and swinging in the dimness. The two rivers men, used to farmers' days, were already making breakfast, some laughing and roughhousing around their cook fires, some grumping, but most getting the work done. A few tried to stay in their blankets and were unceremoniously tumbled out. Grady and Neild were up too, as always off by themselves, shadows in black coats among the trees. Perrin could not recall seeing them without those coats, always buttoned to the neck, always clean and unwrinkled come sunrise, whatever they had looked like the night before. Stepping through the forms in unison, the pair were practicing the sword as they did every morning. That was better than their evening practice, when they would sit cross-legged, hands on knees, staring at some distant nothing. They never did anything that anyone could see, yet not a man in the camp but knew what they were about and kept as far off as possible. Not even the maidens would step into their line of sight then. Something was missing, Perrin realized with a start. Fael always had one of the men meet him first thing with a bowl of the thick porridge they breakfasted on, but it seemed she had been too busy this morning. Brightening, he hurried toward the cook fires, hoping at least to be able to dip his own porridge for once. A small hope. Flan Barstier, a lanky fellow with a dent in his chin, met him halfway and shoved a carved bowl into his hands. Flan was from up toward Watch Hill, and Perrin did not know him well, but they had been hunting together a time or two, and once Perrin had helped him dig one of his father's cows out of a bog hole in the Waterwood.
"The Lady Fael told me to bring this to you, Perrin," Flan said anxiously. "You won't tell her I forgot, will you? You won't tell? I found some honey, and I put in a good dollop."
Perrin tried not to sigh. At least Flan had remembered his name. Well, maybe he could not get away with doing the simplest chores for himself, but he was still responsible for the men eating beneath the trees. Without him, they would be with their families, getting ready for the day's chores around the farm, milking cows and cutting firewood instead of wondering whether they might have to kill or be killed before sunset. Gulping down the honeyed porridge quickly, he told Aram to take his ease over breakfast. But the man looked so miserable that he relented, so Aram followed as he made his way around the camp. The journey was not one Perrin enjoyed. Men put down their bowls when he approached or even stood until he passed. He gritted his teeth whenever somebody he had grown up with, or worse, a man who had sent him on errands as a boy, called him Lord Perrin. Not everyone did, but too many. Far too many. After a time, he gave up telling them to stop out of sheer weariness. All too often the reply was, "Oh, whatever you say, Lord Perrin." It was enough to make a man howl. Despite that, he made himself pause to speak a word or two to every man. Mainly, though, he kept his eyes open and his nose. They all knew well enough to keep their bows in good repair and tend the fletching and points on their arrows. But some would wear the soles out of their boots or the bottom out of their breeches without noticing, or let blisters fester because they could not be bothered to do anything about them just yet. Several had the habit of picking up brandy when they could, and two or three of those had no head for it at all. There had been a small village the day before reaching Bethal that held no fewer than three inns. It was very strange. Having Mistress Luhan or his mother tell him he needed new boots or his breeches mended had always been embarrassing, and he was sure he would have been irritated at the same from anybody else. But from grizzled old John Dinbaran on down, the Two Rivers men just said, "Why, right you are, Lord Perrin. I'll see to it straight away," or some such. He caught a number of them grinning at one another when he moved on. And they smelled pleased. When he rooted a clay jar of pear brandy out of Jory Conger's saddlebags, a skinny fellow who ate twice as much as anyone else and always looked as if he had not had a bite in a week, Jory was a good shot with a bow, but given a chance he would drink until he could not stand, and he had light fingers besides. Jory gave him a wide-eyed look and spread his hands as if he did not know where the jar had come from. But as Perrin walked on, emptying the brandy onto the ground, Jory laughed. "You can't put anything over on Lord Perrin." He sounded proud. Sometimes Perrin thought he was the only sane person left. Another thing he noticed, one and all, they were very interested in what he did not say. Man after man cast an eye toward the two banners that occasionally flapped atop their poles in a brief gust, Red Wolfhead and Red Eagle. They eyed the banners and watched him, waiting for the order he had given every time the things had come out since reaching Gildan. And often enough before that. Except that he had said nothing yesterday, and he said nothing today, and he saw speculation blooming on men's faces. He left behind clusters of men peering at the banners and at him, murmuring excitedly among themselves. He did not try to listen. What would they say if he was wrong, if the White Cloaks or King Auron decided they could look away from the Prophet and the Seanchan long enough to snuff out a supposed rebellion? They were his responsibility, and he had already gotten too many of them killed. The sun was more than peaking above the horizon, spreading a sharp morning light by the time he finished, and over at the tent, Talanvor and Lamgwin were lugging out chests under Linny's direction, while Megdin and Brianna appeared to be sorting the contents out on a broad patch of dead grass, blankets and linens mainly, and long bright swaths of silk satin that had been intended to drape the bed he had misplaced. Fael must have been inside, because that gaggle of idiots were cooling their heels not far off. No carrying and hauling for them, useful as rats in the barn. Perrin thought about taking a look at Stayer and Stepper, but when he glanced through the trees at the horse lines, he was seen. No fewer than three of the farriers stepped out anxiously, watching him. They were blocky men in leather aprons, like as eggs in a basket, though Falton had only a fringe of white around his head, Aemon was graying, and Jerisid had not yet come into his middle years. Perrin growled at the sight of them. They would hover if you laid a hand on either horse, and goggle if you lifted a hoof. The one time he had tried to change a worn shoe, on Stair, all six farriers had darted about, grabbing up tools before he could touch them, nearly knocking the bay over in their rush to do the work themselves.
"They're afraid you don't trust them," Aram said suddenly.
Perrin looked at him in surprise, and Aram shifted his shoulders in his coat.
"I've talked to them some. They think if a lord tends his own horses, it must be because he doesn't trust them. You might send them off with no way to get home."
His tone said they were fools to think that, but he gave Perrin a sideways glance and shrugged again uncomfortably.
"I think they're embarrassed, too. If you don't behave the way they think a lord should, it reflects on them as they see it."
"Light," Perrin muttered.
Fael had said the same, about them being embarrassed anyway, but he had believed it just a lord's daughter talking. Fael had grown up surrounded by servants, yet how could a lady know the thoughts of a man who had to work for his bread? He frowned toward the horse lines. 5 of the farriers stood together watching him now. Embarrassed that he wanted to look after his own horses, and upset that he did not want them pulling wool and scratching gravel all over the place.
"Do you think I ought to act like a fool in silk small clothes?" he asked.
Aram blinked and began studying his boots.
"Light," Perrin growled.
Spotting Basil Gill hurrying from the direction of the carts, Perrin moved to meet him. He did not think he had done very well at making Gill feel at ease yesterday. The stout man was talking to himself and once more mopping his head with a kerchief, sweating away in a rumpled dark gray coat. The day's heat was beginning to take hold already. He did not see Perrin until Perrin was nearly on him, and then he gave a jump, stuffing the kerchief into a coat pocket and making a bow. He looked curried and brushed, fit for a feast day.
"Ah, my lord Perrin, your lady told me to take a cart into Bethal. She says I'm to find you some Two Rivers Tobac if I can. But I don't know if that's possible. Two Rivers Leaf has always been dear, and trade isn't what it was."
"She's sending you for tobacco," Perrin said, frowning. He supposed secrecy had gone down the well, but still.
"I bought 3 casks, 2 villages back, enough for everybody." Gil shook his head firmly.
"Not Two Rivers Leaf, and your lady says you like that above any other. The Gael Dunnan leaf will do for your men. I'm to be your Shambayan," she called it, "and keep you and her supplied with what you need. Not much different from what I did running the Blessing, really."
The similarity seemed to amuse him. His belly shook with quiet chuckles.
"I have quite a list, though I can't say how much of it I'll find. Good wine, herbs, fruit, candles and lamp oil, oilcloth and wax, paper and ink, needles, pins, all sorts of things. Talanvor and Lamgwin and I are going, with some of your lady's other retainers."
His lady's other retainers.
Talanvor and Lamgwin were bringing out yet another chest for the women to sort through. They had to pass by the squatting clump of young fools who never offered to lend a hand. In fact, the layabouts ignored them completely.
"You keep an eye on that lot," Perrin cautioned. "If one of them starts any trouble, if he even looks as if he will, you have Lamgwin crack his head."
And if it was one of the women? They were just as likely, maybe more so. Perrin grunted. Fael's retainers were going to tie his belly into permanent knots yet. Too bad she could not be satisfied with the likes of Master Gill and Megden.
"You didn't mention Balwer, as he decided to go on alone?"
Just then, a shift in the breeze brought him Balwer's scent, an alert smell very much at odds with the fellow's almost desiccated exterior. Even for so reedy a man, Balwer made surprisingly little noise on the dried leaves underfoot. In a sparrow brown coat, he offered a quick bow, and his tilted head added to the image of a bird.
"I am staying, my lord," he said cautiously.
Or maybe that was just his manner.
"As your gracious lady's secretary. And yours, if it pleases you."
He stepped closer, very nearly a hop.
"I am well versed, my lord. I possess a good memory and write a good hand, and my lord can be assured that whatever he confides in me will never pass my lips to another. The ability to keep secrets is a primary skill of a secretary. Don't you have pressing duties for our new mistress, Master Gill?"
Gil frowned at Balwer, opened his mouth, then closed it with a snap. Spinning on his heel, he trotted away toward the tent. For a moment, Balwer watched him go, head to one side, lips pursed thoughtfully.
"I can offer other services as well, my lord," he said finally. "Knowledge. I have overheard some of my lord's men speaking, and I understand that my lord may have had some difficulties with the Children of the Light. A secretary learns many things. I know a surprising amount about the children."
"With any luck, I can avoid white cloaks," Perrin told him. "Better if you knew where the Prophet is, or the Seanchan."
He did not expect any of that, of course, but Balwer surprised him.
"I cannot be certain, of course, but I think the Seanchan have not spread far beyond Amador as yet. Fact is difficult to sift from rumor, my lord, but I keep my ears open. Of course, they do seem to move with unexpected suddenness. A dangerous people with large numbers of Tarabana soldiers. I believe from Master Gil that my lord knows of them, but I observed them closely in Amador, and what I saw is at my lord's disposal. As to the Prophet, there are as many rumors concerning him as the Seanchan, but I believe I can say reliably that he was recently at Abila, a largish town some 40 leagues south of here."
Balwer smiled thinly, a brief, self-satisfied smile.
"How can you be so sure?" Perrin said slowly.
"As I said, my lord, I keep my ears open. The Prophet reportedly closed a number of inns and taverns and tore down those he considered too disreputable. Several were mentioned, and by chance I happen to know there are inns of those names in Abila. I think there is little chance another town would have inns with the same names."
He flashed another narrow smile. He certainly smelled pleased with himself. Perrin scratched his beard thoughtfully.
"The man just happened to remember where some inns that Massima supposedly had torn down were located. And if Massima turned out not to be there after all, well, these days rumors sprouted like mushrooms after rain."
Balwer sounded a man trying to build up his own importance.
"Thank you, Master Balwer. I'll keep that to mind. If you hear any more, be sure to tell me."
As he turned to go, the man caught his sleeve. Balwer's skinny fingers leaped away immediately, as though burned, and he made one of those bird-like bows, dry-washing his hands.
"Forgive me, my lord. I hesitate to press, but do not take the white cloaks too lightly. Avoiding them is wise, but it may not be possible. They are much closer than the Seanchan. Imenvalda, the new Lord Captain Commander, led most of their numbers toward northern Amadicia before Amador fell. He was hunting the Prophet also, my lord. Valda is a dangerous man, and Radam Asunawa, the Grand Inquisitor, makes Valda seem pleasant. And I fear neither has any love for your own lord. Forgive me."
He bowed again, hesitated, then went on smoothly.
"If I may say so, my lord's display of Manetherin's banner is inspired. My lord will be more than a match for Valda and Asunawa if he takes care."
Watching him bow himself away, Perrin thought he knew part of Balwer's story now. Clearly, he also had run afoul of the White Cloaks. That could take no more than being on the same street with them, a frown at the wrong time, but it seemed Balwer had a grudge. A sharp mind, too, seeing right away about the Red Eagle. And a sharp tongue with Master Gil. Gil was on his knees beside Megden, talking rapidly despite Linny's effort to hush him. Megden had turned to stare after Balwer as the fellow hurried through the trees toward the carts. But now and then her gaze swung to Perrin. The rest of them clustered close to her, peering now at Balwer, now at Perrin. If he had ever seen a group of people worried about what somebody else had said, it was they. But what were they worried he might have heard? Backbiting, probably. tales of resentments and misdeeds, real or imagined. People cooped up together tended to start pecking at one another. If that was it, maybe he could put a stop before somebody drew blood. Talonvor was fondling his sword hilt again. What did Fael intend to do with the fellow?
Aram, I want to go talk to Talonvor and that lot. Tell them what Bulwer said to me. Just slide it into the talk, but tell everything.
That should soothe fears of tale-bearing. Fael said servants needed to be made to feel at home.
Make friends with them if you can, Aram. But if you decide to moon over one of the women, be sure it's Linny. The other two are taken.
The man had a smooth tongue for any pretty woman, but he managed to look surprised and offended both.
As you wish, Lord Perrin, he muttered sulkily. I'll catch you up quickly.
I will be over with the Aiel.
Aram blinked.
Ah, yes. Well, it might take a while at that if I'm to make friends with them.
They don't look like they much want friends to me. This from a fellow who stared suspiciously at anyone except Fael, who came near Perrin, and never smiled for anyone not wearing a skirt. Nevertheless, he went over and squatted on his heels where he could speak to Gil and the others. Even from a distance, their standoffishness was plain. They continued with their work, only now and then saying a word to Aram, and they looked at each other as often as at him.
Skittish as green quail in summer, when the foxes were teaching the cubs to hunt. But at least they were talking.
Perrin wondered what mischief Aram had gotten up to with the Aiel. There did not seem to have been any time for it. But he did not wonder long. Any serious trouble with Aiel usually meant someone dead and not the Aiel. In truth, he was not so eager to meet the wise ones himself. He walked around the curve of the hill, but instead of climbing the slope, his feet carried him all the way to the Mayenners. He had stayed away from their camp as much as possible, too, and not simply because of Berylaine. There were disadvantages to having too keen a nose. Fortunately, a freshening breeze was carrying most of the stink away, though it did little for the heat. Sweat rolled down the faces of the mounted sentries in their red armor. At the sight of him, they sat up even more rigidly in their saddles, which was saying something. Where the Two Rivers men rode like fellows heading out to the fields, the Mayenners usually were statues on horseback. They could fight, though. The light said there was no need. Javi and Norella came running, buttoning up his coat, before Perrin was well past the sentries. The dozen or so other officers followed at Norella's heels, all coated and some fastening the straps of their red breastplates. Two or three carried helmets with thin red plumes tucked under their arms. Most were years older than Norella, some twice his age, graying men with hard, scarred faces. But Norella's reward for helping to rescue Rand had been to be named Gallien's second, his first lieutenant, they called it.
"The first hasn't returned yet, Lord Perrin," Norella said, making a bow mirrored by the others.
A tall, slender man, he did not look as young as he had before Dumais Wells. There was an edge to his eyes, which had seen more blood than most veterans of 20 battles. But if his face was harder, there was still an eagerness to please in his scent. To Javi and Norella, Perrin Ibarra was a man who could fly or walk on water as he chose.
"The morning patrols saw nothing. Those that are back. I would have reported otherwise."
"Of course," Perrin told him. "I just wanted to look about a bit."
He simply meant to walk around until he could work up his nerve to face the wise ones, but the young Mayenner followed him with the rest of the officers, anxiously watching for Lord Perrin to find some flaw in the winged guards, wincing whenever they came on bare-chested men tossing dice on a blanket or some fellow snoring away with the sun on the climb. He need not have bothered. To Perrin, the camp looked laid out with a plumb line and level. Each man had his blankets and his saddle for a pillow not more than 2 paces from where his horse was tied to one of the long ropes drooping between chest-high poles, set upright in the ground. A cook fire stood every 20 paces, with lances stacked in steel-tipped cones between. The whole made a sort of box around 5 peaked tents, one striped golden blue and larger than the other 4 combined. All very different from the Two Rivers men's every-which-way arrangement. Perrin walked along briskly, trying not to look too much a fool. He was not sure how much success he was having. He itched to stop and look over a horse or two, just to be able to pick up a hoof without somebody practically fainting. But mindful of what Aram had said, he kept his hands to himself. Everyone seemed as startled as Norella at his pace. Tough-eyed bannermen chivied men to their feet, only to have Perrin stride by with a nod before they were all upright. A puzzled murmur trailed in the air behind him, and his ears caught a few comments about officers, lords in particular, that he was just as glad Norella and the others missed. Finally, he found himself on the verge of the camp, staring up the brushy slope toward the Wise One's tents. Only a few of the maidens were visible among the scattered trees up there, and some of the Gaishine.
"Lord Perrin," Norella said hesitantly. "I said I."
He stepped closer and lowered his voice to a hoarse whisper.
"I know they swore to the Lord Dragon, and I've seen things, Lord Perrin. They do camp chores. I said I. This morning, Masuri and Seonid came down to fetch water. And yesterday, after you returned, yesterday I thought I heard someone up there crying out. It couldn't have been one of the sisters, of course," he added hurriedly, and laughed to show how ridiculous the idea was, a very shaky laugh.
You will see that everything is all right with them?"
He had ridden into 40,000 Shido, leading 200 lancers, but talking about this had him hunching his shoulders and shifting his feet. Of course, he had ridden into 40,000 Shido because an Aes Sedai wanted him to. "I'll do what I can," Perrin muttered. Maybe matters were worse than he had thought. Now he had to stop them getting worse still, if he could. He would rather have faced the Shido again. Norella nodded as though Perrin had promised all he had asked and more. "That is well, then," he said, sounding relieved. Casting sideways glances at Perrin, he worked himself up to say something else, but apparently this was not so touchy as the Aes Sedai. "I heard that you let the Red Eagle stay." Perrin very nearly jumped. Even for just around the hill, news had traveled fast.
"It seemed the thing to do," he said slowly.
Berylaine would have to know the truth, yet if too many knew, that truth would spread from the next village they passed, the next farm. "This used to be part of Manetherin," he added, as if Norella did not know that perfectly well. Truth. He had gotten so he could bend truth like an Aes Sedai, and to men on his side. "Not the first time that flag's been raised around here, I'll warrant. But none of those fellows had the dragon reborn behind him." And if that did not set the necessary seeds, he did not know how to plow a furrow. Abruptly he realized that what seemed every last one of the winged guards was watching him with their officers, no doubt wondering what he was saying, after all but running through that way. Even the lean, balding old soldier Gallien called his dog robber had come out to stare, and Berylaine's maids, a pair of plump, plain-faced women, garbed to match their mistress's tent. Perrin had hardly seen a thing, but he knew he had to give some sort of praise. Raising his voice enough to carry, he said, "The winged guards will do Mayen proud if we ever face another Dumai's Wells." Those were the first words that came to mind, but he winced at saying them. To his shock, shouting rose straight away among the soldiers, cheering, "Perrin Golden Eyes," and "Mayen for Golden Eyes," and "Golden Eyes and Manetherin." Men danced and capered, and some snatched lances from the stacks to shake them so the red streamers waved in the breeze. Grizzled bannermen watched them with arms folded, nodding approval. Norella beamed, and not only him. Officers with gray in their hair and scars on their faces grinned like boys praised at their lessons. Light, he was the only sane man left. He prayed never to see another battle. Wondering whether this was going to cause trouble with Berylaine, he made his goodbyes with Norella and the others, and tramped up the slope through dead or dying brush, none of it waist high. Brown weeds crackled beneath his boots. Shouting still filled the Mayenner camp.
Even after she learned the truth, the First might not be pleased to have her soldiers cheering him this way. Of course, that could have good points. Maybe she would be angry enough to stop pestering him. Short of the crest, he paused, listening to the cheers finally fade away. No one was going to cheer him here. All of the side flaps were down on the Wise One's low gray-brown tents, closing them in. Only a few of the maidens were in sight now. Squatting easily on their heels beneath a leather leaf that still showed some green, they eyed him curiously. Their hands moved quickly in that way they had of talking among themselves with signs. After a moment, Sulan rose, shifting her heavy belt knife, and strode in his direction, a tall, wiry woman with a pink scar across her sun-dark cheek. She glanced back down the way he had come and seemed relieved that he was alone, though it was often hard to tell with Aiel. "That is good, Perrin Ebarra," she said quietly. "The Wise Ones have not been pleased that you make them come to you. Only a fool displeases Wise Ones, and I have not taken you for a fool." Perrin scrubbed at his beard. He had been keeping clear of the Wise Ones and the Aes Sedai as much as possible, but he had had no intention of forcing them to come to him. He just found their company uncomfortable, to put it mildly. "Well, I need to see Adara now," he told her, "about the Aes Sedai."
"Perhaps I was mistaken after all," Sulan said dryly. "But I will tell her." Turning, she paused. "Tell me something. Terrell Winter and Furin Alhara are close to Siona Dryhan, like first brothers with a first sister. She does not like men as men, yet they offer to take her punishment for her. How could they shame her so?"
He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. A pair of Gaishin appeared from the reverse slope, each leading two of the Aiel's pack mules. The white-robed men passed within a few paces, heading down toward the stream. He could not be sure, but he thought both were Shido. The pair kept their eyes meekly down, barely looking up enough to see where they were going. They had had every opportunity to run away, doing chores like that without anyone to watch. A peculiar people.
"I see you are shocked, too," Sulan said. "I had hoped you could explain. I will tell Adara."
As she started for the tents, she added over her shoulder,
"You wetlanders are very strange, Perrin Ebarra."
Perrin frowned after her, and when she vanished into one of the tents, he turned to frown at the two Gaishin leading the horses to water.
"Wetlanders were strange? Light."
Cinderella had been right in what he heard. It was beyond time to stick his nose into what was going on between the Wise Ones and the Aes Sedai. He should have before this. He wished he did not think it would be the same as sticking his nose into a hornet's nest. It seemed to take a long time for Sulan to reappear, and she did little to help his mood when she did. Holding the tent flap for him, she flicked his belt knife contemptuously with a finger as he ducked through.
"You should be better armed for this dance, Perrin Ebarra," she said.
Inside, he was surprised to find all six Wise Ones sitting cross-legged on colorful tasseled cushions, their shawls tied around their waists and their skirts making carefully arranged fans across the layered rugs. He had hoped for just Adara. None looked to be more than 4 or 5 years older than he, some no older at all, yet somehow they always made him feel as if he were facing the oldest members of the women's circle, the ones who had spent years learning to sniff out whatever you wanted to hide. Separating one woman's scent from another's was all but impossible, but he hardly needed to. Six sets of eyes latched onto him, from Janina's pale sky blue to Marlene's purple twilight, not to mention Navarin's sharp green. Every eye could have been a skewer. Adara brusquely motioned him to take a cushion himself, which he did with gratitude, though it put him facing them all in a semicircle. Maybe Wise Ones had designed these tents to make men bend their necks if they wanted to stand upright. Strangely, it was cooler in the dim interior, but he still felt like sweating. Maybe he could not pick one from another, yet these women smelled like wolves studying a tethered goat.
A square-faced guy Shine, who was half again as big as he was, knelt to offer a golden cup of dark wine punch on an elaborate silver tray. The wise ones already had mismatched silver cups and goblets. Unsure what it meant that he was being offered gold, maybe nothing, yet who could say with Aiel, Perrin took it cautiously. It gave off the scent of plums. The fellow bowed meekly enough when Adara clapped her hands and bent himself out of the tent backward, but the half-healed slash down his hard face had to date from Demise Wells. "Now that you are here," Adara said as soon as the tent flap dropped behind the Gashine, "we will explain again why you must kill the man called Masima Dagar." "We should not have to explain again," Delora put in. Her hair and eyes were nearly the same shade as Magden's, but no one would call her pinched face pretty. Her manner was pure ice. "This Masima Dagar is a danger to the Karakhan. He must die." "The Dreamwalkers have told us, Perrin Ebarra." Corella certainly was pretty, and though her fiery hair and piercing eyes made her look as though she had a temper, she was always mild. For a wise one. And certainly not soft. "They have read the dream. The man must die." Perrin took a swallow of plum punch to gain a moment. Somehow the punch was cool. It was always the same with them. Rand had not mentioned any warning from the Dreamwalkers. The first time Perrin had mentioned that, only the once, they had thought he was casting doubt on their word, and even Corella had gone hot-eyed. Not that Perrin thought they would lie. Not exactly. He had not caught them in one anyway. But what they wanted for the future, and what Rand wanted, what he himself wanted for that matter, might be very different things. Maybe it was Rand who was keeping secrets. "If you could just give me some idea what this danger is," he said finally. "The Light knows Masima's a madman, but he supports Rand. A fine thing if I go around killing people on our side. That will certainly convince people to join Rand." Sarcasm was lost on them. They looked at him, unblinking. "The man must die," Adara said at last. "It is enough that 3 Dreamwalkers have said so, and 6 wise ones tell you." The same as always. Maybe they did not know any more than that, and maybe he should get on with why he had come. "I want to talk about Sionid and Masuri," he said, and 6 faces turned to Frost. Like these women could stare down a stone. Setting the wine cup beside him, he leaned toward them stubbornly. "I'm supposed to show people Aes Sedai sworn to Rand." He was supposed to show Masima, actually, but this did not seem a good time to mention that. "They aren't going to be very cooperative if you lot beat them. Light, they're Aes Sedai. Instead of making them haul water, why don't you learn from them? They must know all sorts of things you don't." Too late, he bit his tongue. The Aiel women did not take offense, though. Not that it showed, anyway. "They know some things we do not," Delora told him firmly, "and we know some they do not." As firmly as a spear point in the ribs. "We learn what there is to learn, Perrin Ebarra," Marlene said calmly, combing nearly black hair with her fingers. She was one of the few Aiel he had seen with such dark hair, and she often toyed with it. "And we teach what there is to teach." "In any event," Janina said, "it is none of your affair. Men do not interfere between wise ones and apprentices." She shook her head over his foolishness. "You may stop listening outside and come in, Sionid Trigon," Adara said suddenly. Perrin blinked in surprise, but none of the women batted an eye. There was a moment of silence, then the tent flap twitched aside, and Sionid ducked inside, kneeling quickly on the rugs. That vaunted Aes Sedai serenity was shattered in her. Her mouth was a thin line, her eyes tight, her face red. She smelled of anger, frustration, and a dozen more emotions, all whirling about so quickly that Perrin could barely separate any out. "May I speak to him?" she asked in a stiff voice. "If you take care what you say," Adara told her. Sipping her wine, the wise one watched over the rim of her cup. A teacher watching a pupil? A hawk watching a mouse? Perrin could not be sure. Except that Adara was very sure of her place, whatever the pairing. So was Sionid. But that did not carry over to him. She twisted around to face him on her knees, back going straight, eyes heated. Anger raged in the smell of her. "Whatever you know," she said angrily, "whatever you think you know, you will forget." No, there was not a shred of serenity left in her. "Whatever is between the wise ones and us is for us alone. You will stand aside, avert your eyes, and keep your mouth closed." Amazed, Perrin raked his fingers through his hair. "Light, you're upset because I know you got a switching?" he said incredulously. Well, he would have been too, but not alongside the rest. "Don't you know these women would as soon cut your throat as look at you? Slit your throat and leave you by the side of the road? Well, I promised myself I wouldn't let that happen. I don't like you, but I promised to protect you from the wise ones, or the Ashaman or Rand himself. So come down off that high horse." Realizing he was shouting, he drew a deep, embarrassed breath and settled back on his cushion, snatched up his wine cup, and took a long drink. Siona went stiffer by the word with indignation, and her lip curled well before he finished.
"You promised?" she sneered. "You think Aes Sedai need your protection? You—"
"Enough," Adara said quietly, and Siona's jaw snapped shut, though her hands made white-knuckled fists clutching her skirts. "What makes you think we would kill her, Perrin Ebarra?" Janina asked curiously. Aiel seldom showed much on their faces, but the others frowned at him or looked with open incredulity.
"I know how you feel," he replied slowly. "I've known since I saw you with the sisters after Dumai's wells."
He was not about to explain that he had smelled their hatred, their contempt, every time a wise one looked at an Aes Sedai back then. He did not smell it now, but no one could maintain that level of fury for long without bursting. That did not mean it was gone, only that it had sunk deep, maybe into the bone. Delora snorted, a sound like linen ripping.
"First you say they must be cuddled because you need them, and now because they are Aes Sedai, and you have promised to protect them. Which is truth, Perrin Ebarra?"
"Both."
Perrin met Delora's hard gaze for a long moment, then eyed each of the others in turn.
"Both are true, and I mean both."
The wise ones exchanged glances, the sort where every flicker of an eyelid held 100 words and no man could make out a one. Finally, in a shifting of necklaces and readjusting of tied shawls, they appeared to reach agreement.
"We do not kill apprentices, Perrin Ebarra," Navarin said.
She sounded shocked at the idea.
"When Randall Thor asked us to apprentice them, perhaps he thought it was just to make them obey us, but we do not speak empty words. They are apprentices now."
"They will remain so until 5 wise ones agree they are ready to be more," Marlene added, sweeping her long hair over her shoulder. "And they are treated no differently than any others."
Adara nodded over her wine cup.
"Tell him the advice you would give him concerning Masima Dagar, Sionid Trigon," she said.
The kneeling woman had practically writhed during Navarin and Marlene's short speeches, gripping her skirt until Perrin thought the silk might rip, but she wasted no time complying with Adara's instructions.
"The wise ones are right, whatever their reasons. I do not say this because they wish it."
She drew herself up again, smoothing her features with a visible effort. A touch of heat still flared in her voice, though.
"I saw the work of so-called Dragon Sworn before I ever met Randall Thor. Death and destruction to no purpose. Even a faithful dog must be put down if he begins to foam at the mouth."
"Blood and ashes," Perrin grumbled. "How can I even let you in the sight of the man after that? You swore fealty to Rand. You know that isn't what he wants. What about that 'thousands will die if you fail'?"
Light, if Masuri felt the same, then he had to put up with Aes Sedai and wise ones for nothing. No, worse. he would have to guard Massima from them.
"Masuri knows Massima for Rabbit as well as I," Sionid replied when he put the question to her.
All of her serenity had returned. She regarded him with a cool, unreadable face. Her scent was sharply alert, intent. As if he needed his nose, with her eyes fixed on his, big and dark and bottomless.
"I swore to serve the dragon reborn, and the best service I can give him now is to keep this animal from him. Bad enough that rulers know Massima supports him. Worse if they see him embrace the man. And thousands will die if you fail to get close enough to Massima to kill him."
Perrin thought his head would spin. Again an Aes Sedai whirled words about like a top, made it seem she had said black when she meant white. Then the wise ones added their bit.
"Masuri Sakawa," Nevarin said calmly, "believes the rabid dog can be leashed and bound so he may be used safely."
For an instant, Sionid looked as surprised as Perrin felt, but she recovered quickly. Outside, she did. Her scent was suddenly wary, as if she sensed a trap where she had not expected one.
"She also wishes to fit you for a halter, Perrin Ebarra," Corella added, even more casually. "She thinks you must be bound also, to make you safe."
Nothing on her freckled face told whether she agreed. Adara raised a hand toward Sionid.
"You may go now. You will not listen further, but you may ask Garadin again to let you heal the wound on his face. Remember, if he still refuses, you must accept it. He is Gaishin, not one of your wetlander's servants."
She invested that last word with depths of scorn. Sionid stared icy augurs at Perrin. She looked at the wise ones, her lips trembling on the brink of speech. In the end, though, all she could do was go with as good a grace as she could muster. Outwardly, that was considerable, an Aes Sedai being Aes Sedai, fit to shame a queen. But the scent she trailed behind her was frustration sharp enough to cut. As soon as she was gone, the six wise ones focused on Perrin again.
"Now," Adara said, "you can explain to us why you would put a rabid animal next to the Karakarn." "Only a fool obeys another's command to push him over a cliff," Nevarin said. "You will not listen to us," Janina said, "so we will listen to you. Speak, Perrin Ebarra."
Perrin considered making a break for the door flaps, but if he did, he would leave behind one Aes Sedai who might possibly be of some doubtful help, and another, along with six wise ones, who were all set to ruin everything he had come to do. He put his wine cup down again and settled his hands on his knees. He needed a clear head if he was to show these women he was no tethered goat.